Today at Reader's Corner, Edward Acorn, author of The Lincoln Miracle, Inside the Republican Convention That Changed History. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Illinois lawyer Abraham Lincoln had a record of political failure. In 1858, he had lost a celebrated Senate bid against incumbent Stephen Douglas, his second failed Senate run, and had not held public office since one term in Congress a decade earlier. Such was the political landscape as Edward Acorn's The Lincoln Miracle opens on the eve of the fateful 1860 Republican National Convention. Chronicling the tense political drama as it unfolded over the next 6 days, Ed Acorn explores the genius of Lincoln's quiet strategy, the vicious partisanship tearing apart America, the fierce battles raging over racism and slavery, and booming Chicago as a symbol of the modernization transforming the nation. Edward Acorn is a Pulitzer Prize finalist for commentary and the author of Every Drop of Blood, The Momentous Second Inauguration of Abraham Lincoln, as well as two acclaimed books about 19th century baseball and American culture, 59 and 84, and The Summer of Beer and Whiskey. Ed Acorn, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Oh, so great to be here, Bob.
Well, this is just was a great read. I so much enjoyed it. As I mentioned to you earlier, I lived in Springfield for a period of time, and therefore I thought I had my fill of Lincoln, but you can never get your fill of Lincoln, especially with a book like yours. It was absolutely priceless in bringing us into this political drama. Why don't we just start with the 1860 Republican Convention and the wigwam? Tell us about this large it was just built not too long before the 1860 convention, I believe. What'd this thing look like?
Well, right. Chicago was the city that had risen from nothing really in 25 years. And now it was a thriving city, and they wanted to show off just how much energy and talent people in Chicago had. So they decided, instead of using an existing building, which all of them were too small, they decided to build this thing, and they put it up in just 6 weeks. It was a giant wooden box, essentially. And it was, you could stuff 11,000 people into this. There was no amplification aside from the human voice, but the architect curved the ceiling so you could hear speakers in every part of the hall. And the ladies of Chicago decorated it with bunting and with evergreens and all sorts of stuff. And you can imagine with the gas lights flaring in this thing and no real easy exit, as Bruce Catton, the historian, said, it must have been the greatest fire trap ever built in America. And but fortunately, it didn't burn down with them in it.
Exactly. And it is amazing that it managed to live out its life, having been torn down instead of burned down, I guess you could say. But it is the beginning of a tale that I don't think most people really begin to understand. And I guess to begin to understand it, we have to start with Stephen Douglas and his take on slavery and African Americans, because, of course, this was the fundamental issue of the 1860 election.
Well, yeah, Douglas was the rising star of the Democratic Party, and he was from Illinois, and he had fought Lincoln in 1858 for the Senate seat. And Lincoln had, was considered sort of a sacrificial lamb, but then he went into it and managed to get debates with Douglas, and he staggered everyone by really putting Douglas on the ropes. And Douglas was a fierce and vicious debater. Douglas had tried to sort of square the circle of slavery by saying, let's no longer deal with it at the federal level. Let's have individual territories that were trying to become states, have the territories vote whether they want slavery or not, put it in the hands of the people and they can decide. And this got rid of years of policy about slavery, which was, it was held to the South under the Missouri Compromise, and the free territories were to the North. And all of a sudden, Douglas was screwing this up with his policy. And that really got Lincoln involved in politics. He thought it was a terrible thing that you would subject something like slavery to the will of the voters, that that would say it's, you can be voted up and down, and Lincoln thought it was a moral wrong and we have to keep it out of the territories. Right. So that was the major difference between Lincoln and Douglas.
Mm-hmm. So when it comes to Lincoln-Douglas debates, and again, as I mentioned to you before we went on the air, I lived there and I visited every one of those debate sites and read some of the commentary, not all of it. Those things would go on for hours. I couldn't believe that. I mean, can you imagine anybody today listening in the what, 80 degree temperatures in the summertime in one of these small towns in Illinois?
Extraordinary. And it's with no amplification. They were just shouting out to the audience and they had to be very sharp. These debates would last 3 hours. I mean, they really were intense. And that sort of put Lincoln on the map a little bit. Yeah. But he was still a tremendous underdog going into this convention.
Yeah, I think you mentioned in the book that there's one thing about those Lincoln-Douglas debates that sticks with Lincoln, maybe makes him the moderate on the Republican side. Douglas kind of... I don't know whether you'd say put Lincoln in the corner, but Lincoln had to take a stance on slavery and African Americans that is sometimes quoted and isn't the same take you get on him as the great emancipator.
Well, right. Douglas tried to frame Lincoln as somebody who wanted absolute equal rights between blacks and whites. And Lincoln sort of did want that, but he couldn't get elected if he said it. So he sort of got rather cagey in the debates and said, you know, just because I don't want a black woman for a wife doesn't mean I want her as a slave. And so he, you know, there's a tendency in modern historical analysis to look at the worst thing about any of the heroes in America, Lincoln being one, and to try to puff that up and make Lincoln into some kind of terrible white supremacist. But if you look at his record, he was the least racist person I've run into in the 19th century. Right. He was extraordinarily friendly with black people. He treated them as equals, and he was very much ahead of his time in that regard.
And however people took whatever Lincoln said in those Lincoln-Douglas debates, it would, to some extent, I guess, serve him well in his upcoming fight for the nomination against William Seward. And I want you to tell us about him, because he's at the other end of the spectrum.
Well, not really. I mean, Seward and Lincoln were very similar in many ways. But Lincoln was not as famous as Seward, so he wasn't as controversial. Lincoln was sort of helped by his low profile. William Seward was the star of the Republican Party. I mean, really, the superstar. He was considered its founder and father and had developed the party. He had been a former governor of New York, which was the richest and most powerful state. He had been a U.S. senator for many years, and he was at the forefront of the fight against slavery. So he went into this convention. Everybody thought, well, not everybody, but many people thought this would be his convention. And the nomination was almost a sure thing. And what Lincoln's friends and others quickly discovered was that many of these delegates, who are professional politicians from around the country, were very nervous about having Seward at the top of the ticket because he had been such a strong opponent of slavery and actually a supporter of immigrants. And those were both kind of dicey with elements of the Republican Party, especially swing voters. And they had to worry about attracting swing voters in the upcoming election.
There were a considerable number of German and Irish immigrants that these candidates were after. Is that not the case?
Yeah, that's one of the interesting things you discover is that there were German Americans who were very prominent in politics at the time. They were very tiny percentage of the Republican base. Most immigrants voted Democrat, but there was a tiny percentage of German Americans, but they were enough to swing a number of states in the North. So the Republicans had to be worried about them. And that really played into the fact Lincoln won this nomination, because the chief moderate alternative to Seward was this guy named Edward Bates from Missouri, very conservative guy, a judge. He didn't like all the slavery agitation, but he had been the sort of associated with this anti-immigrant party, the Know-Nothing Party that was called the American Party. And the Germans actually held a national convention in Chicago the same week as the Republican convention, right down the street. And they did that just to send a message: if you nominate Bates, we're going to bolt. So all this stuff sort of really played into Lincoln's hands. It's quite amazing, almost a miracle how it all lined up.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Edward Acorn, author of The Lincoln Miracle, Inside the Republican Convention That Changed History. So let's talk about the journalism of today and of that day. And you can't talk about the journalism of that day without talking about Horace Greeley. You call him the biggest star in American journalism at that point. Tell us about him and how, in the end, he gets the rap for Seward not getting the nomination.
Well, this is another thing that played into Lincoln's hands. Horace Greeley was the editor of the New York Tribune, and he was the most powerful newspaper editor in the country. And he had been friends with William Seward and Seward's manager, Thurlow Weed. And they had formed like a triumvirate running New York politics for decades. But Greeley got offended and broke with Seward and Weed because they refused to make him the lieutenant governor of New York. In those days, being a major editor wasn't enough. They wanted to have actual political power. So Greeley was very offended at Seward and Weed, and he actually went out to Chicago and worked to get Seward defeated. He spent all week saying, look, Seward's too controversial. He's too liberal. He's not going to attract swing voters. You're going to lose if you put him at the top of the ticket. And all these people at the convention thought, he's still Seward's friend. Why is he saying this? We'd better listen to him. And that was a big part of Seward going down to defeat. And with him bad-mouthing Seward, the delegates had to look around for some alternative to Seward. And that's eventually how Lincoln emerged.
And boy, Seward never forgot the role Greeley played, did he?
No, they had strong memories back then. And actually, Thurlow Weed was this brilliant manager of Seward. He actually made it a goal of his to thwart Greeley in the future, and he prevented him from being U.S. Senator in 1861.
There's another journalist in your book that struck a bell, Medill. Medill is a famous name in Chicago because it happens to be the name of the School of Journalism at Northwestern University. But what I found so interesting about Medill is that you have him over in, he's a reporter covering the convention, right?
But well, he was an editor of the Chicago Tribune. So he's supposed, you know, in our modern times, or until recently,
right.
Journalism was supposed to be nonpartisan. And he was a pure partisan. He was sitting there. He was working all week to help nominate Lincoln. And he actually sat with the delegates
in Ohio.
In the Ohio delegation to try to sway them the morning of the voting. So it was a different world back then. And these editors got very involved, and they were very vicious, actually.
Yeah, I thought that was absolutely amazing. So there's three ballots in the convention as far as Lincoln getting nominated is concerned. Why don't you set up how this works? Because it's really the first ballot that in many ways is the most important to the Lincoln folks, because if that one's blown, then it's all over. But yeah, tell us what happens.
Well, can I go back a little bit?
Sure.
Is that all right?
Absolutely.
The convention opened on Wednesday. On Thursday, nobody has emerged as an opponent to Seward, a strong enough opponent. There's vote after vote that's the Seward team wins. And then they decide to have the nominations late in the afternoon, early evening. And what happened was a guy announced from the rostrum, we don't have the tally sheets available yet. It'll be 5 minutes. and the delegates were tired and hungry, and they decided to adjourn rather than wait 5 minutes for the tally sheets. And it was during that night that the Lincoln people went to work. So the next morning, everybody shows up. They expect Seward's going to be easily nominated. And they didn't think there was any strong opponent to Seward. And what had happened is Lincoln's people made deals over the night. So the first ballot showed Seward way ahead, but Lincoln was the guy who was his chief opponent. And as the voting went on, some of these really important delegations like Pennsylvania swung into line for Lincoln. And that actually gave him the nomination on the third ballot. People were just staggered in the hall that this was going on. It was totally unexpected.
So along the way there was an issue of some counterfeit tickets that seemed to emerge the morning of the third ballot. Why don't you tell this story? This shows you're in Chicago when this happened.
That's a very Chicago story. Well, I mentioned Thurlow Weed, who was the brilliant manager of William Seward. He raised all sorts of money, and he funded a travel to Chicago of thousands of Seward supporters so they could fill up the wigwam and present this image that Seward is a sure thing and so forth. So for Wednesday and Thursday, they had been there in the wigwam screaming for Seward, and the Lincoln people realized we got to do something about this. So Thursday night, apparently, somebody on the Lincoln team printed up counterfeit tickets to the wigwam, and they forged them with the names of Republican Party officials, and they gave them to Lincoln supporters. So the Seward men were doing things like staging these giant marches in Chicago to show how much support they had. And they did that Friday morning. They were marching to the wigwam expecting, you know, Seward's coronation that morning. And when they got there, they discovered many of their seats had been taken by Lincoln people, even though they had legitimate tickets to get in, and they couldn't get in. So therefore, on Friday morning, there was tons of screaming for Lincoln, actually louder than for Seward. And that may have swayed some delegates to go along with Lincoln.
So Lincoln was offered a deal early on. Tell us about that.
Oh, yeah. Seward kept trying to offer Lincoln the vice presidency. And Lincoln's forces rebuffed that because they thought they had an actual chance and they wouldn't do something like that until after the nomination was over. And they also didn't want to get associated with Seward. They wanted to present themselves to every other delegation as the second best choice. Mm-hmm. So the Bates people, if they couldn't get Bates in, Lincoln's a good second choice. Same with the Sam and Chase people. If you can't get Chase in, Lincoln's your best bet. Same with Seward. So they were trying to, the strategy of Lincoln, which was very smart, don't offend any of these other delegations. Don't criticize their candidates. Just say, if you can't get your guy, he's a good compromise candidate. So that was essentially their strategy.
Sure. Now, we've talked about a few people at this convention, but the one person we haven't talked about at this convention is Lincoln himself, because he wasn't there.
Right.
And I want you to tell the story of what was going on in Springfield at this time. That is, what was Lincoln doing down there? It was a different day when presidential candidates steered clear of the convention, even the ratification rally, I guess. But here's what I learned, Ed, that I didn't know. I didn't know handball existed in the 1860s, okay? And I didn't know Lincoln played handball. So, among other things, you can fill us in on
that. The candidates in those days did not go to the conventions. They were considered above that, and that would have been tacky, and it would have shown that they were too self-interested. So they made this pose of standing in the background. So Seward was in Auburn, New York, where his mansion was, and Lincoln was in Springfield. And Lincoln actually contemplated going to the convention. He said, I feel like too much of a candidate to go, but not enough of one to stay home. So he was really tortured about whether he should go. And he finally stayed home, thank God, because that showed he was a serious candidate. So he spent the week, he was getting constant communications with the people up in Chicago representing him, telegrams and letters and so forth. And he tried to burn off energy, nervous energy, by playing handball, which he loved this game. I wish it was baseball. I really am disappointed.
Really?
It's not baseball, but it was handball. And he said it made his shoulders feel good because he had these long arms and could whip the ball against the wall and so forth. And so I describe his games of handball there as he tried to work out the nervous energy while he waited for the votes. And that morning he had, he had no idea he was going to be nominated. In fact, the night before he had sent a message up to his people in Chicago, make no deals in my name. You know, Lincoln wanted to be free to appoint who he wanted to the cabinet. And Lincoln's manager there said, everybody was like, we have no chance of winning this nomination unless we make deals. And Lincoln's manager, David Davis, who was a judge, said, Lincoln ain't here. And he put the message, set the message aside and said, whatever, we're going to make deals, and whatever we do, he'll have to ratify it. So that's what they did.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. I was amused by a quote that you found where Davis is asked later on in life what role those deals played, when clearly Lincoln didn't want those deals to happen. And I guess somebody said, did you prevaricate? And I think he said, no, I didn't prevaricate. It was a damn lie.
He said prevaricated. We lied like hell. And they did. They promised multiple jobs to different delegations, and they actually traded cabinet seats for support. And that's how they got the all-important Pennsylvania delegation on board. They actually promised the Treasury Department to this very corrupt politician named Simon Cameron. So that was just the nature of politics then and now, I believe,
Yeah. I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Edward Acorn, author of The Lincoln Miracle, Inside the Republican Convention That Changed History. In the book, Acorn offers a behind-the-scenes look at Abraham Lincoln's history-changing nomination to lead the Republican Party in the 1860 presidential election. Well, let's talk about the vice presidency. Once Lincoln is nominated, he's got to figure out who is going to be his vice president. And there was a very popular statesman at the time by the name of Cassius Clay. That name will ring a bell with boxing fans, but this goes back way before the boxing champion came along. Tell us about that decision nominate.
The candidates then didn't get to choose their own vice president. So Lincoln was just in Springfield. He had no idea what they were doing. After the vote for Lincoln, the Seward people were furious. They said, this is ridiculous. What a joke of a convention. They nominate this rail splitter over Seward, who has all the experience in the world. And they were very angry. And there was concern that New York wouldn't be involved in the election and wouldn't provide the money and support the party needed to win. So they had to figure out, how can we assuage the New Yorkers? And they offered the vice presidency to them, and they were so furious. They wanted nothing to do with it. And then finally they settled on this guy who was a Seward supporter from Maine named Hannibal Hamlin. And he was a former Democrat. Lincoln was a former Whig. He was from the East. Lincoln was from the Midwest. And so he sort of balanced the ticket. He was a Washington insider. He was a senator. And Lincoln was a Washington outsider. So they figured this guy would balance the ticket. And he had no idea he was going to be nominated. They went to a group of people went to his door and banged on it at 9 o'clock at night. And Hamlin was playing cards with his friends in Washington. And he opens the door and they said, congratulations, Mr. Vice President. He said, what are you talking about? They said, you've been nominated for vice president. He said, I don't want the job. But they eventually persuaded him. So it was Lincoln and Hamlin running for president and vice president.
So tell our listeners what the turnout was like in 1860. I thought that was quite amazing.
Oh, there was a very high turnout. I don't have the number off the top of my head, but it was
just over 80%.
You know, but it was a different sort of thing. It was white males essentially, and it was women didn't vote, and not all white males voted. There were in some areas there were property requirements and so forth. So it was a smaller group, but they were very passionately into politics, and especially in 1860. So, and Lincoln was not even on the ballot in the Deep South because there were no Republicans in the Deep South. They would have been killed if they raised their heads up in the Deep South. Mm-hmm. So Lincoln was not even on the ballot in many of these states, but he won. He won the Electoral College overwhelmingly because of his strength in the North. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, he got the lowest percentage of the popular vote of any president elected in our history. So he had to worry very much about trying to bring the country together after this election.
I think the reader does need to be reminded, as you just did, that women didn't have the right to vote at that time, because as I read your book, I found a number of references to women playing a role,
yes,
in American politics and in Chicago at the convention. You might share with us just that was a pretty important, when you referred earlier to the stacking of the wigwam, that had to do with women.
Well, women, you know, women didn't vote, but they were very involved in politics, sort of. They read newspapers, they talked to their husbands, they had a lot of clout. In a sort of secretive way in that society. And many people thought women were the ones who decided these elections by virtue of their influence over their husbands. It was interesting, during the campaign, there was an 11-year-old girl who, named Grace Bedell from New York State, who wrote to Lincoln and said, gee, your face is so thin, maybe you should grow some whiskers, and the ladies would find you more attractive and persuade their husbands to vote for you. So that's when Lincoln began growing his famous beard. So it was the influence of women in politics that drove him to do it.
There's a quote in your book that reminds me once again of how many things people have taken from the Lincoln presidency and incorporated into their own lives. Especially, you get all these books on management, and every now and then they'll be talking about the Lincoln walking around management style. Yeah. But you've got one here, and maybe you can just comment on it after I read it. He had a rare gift for overlooking even the contempt and betrayal of political associates, believing that ignoring slights and seeking to save relationships paid off in the end. Do good to those who hate you and turn their ill will to friendship, he advised his wife. Boy, there's a lesson of life and career, no matter what you're doing.
Isn't that tremendous? I mean, yeah. And it's so counter to what our politics is today. I mean, everybody on both sides takes all these slights and gets offended and attacks people personally and all that. Lincoln refused to engage in that, and that made all the difference, actually, in his nomination. He had friends who had been angry at him about certain political decisions he had to make over the years, and some of them insulted him and treated him very badly, and he would rise above it, and he would try to maintain friendships any way he could, and that served him very well in this convention. He had a whole team of people from Illinois who swarmed in to help out in Chicago and get him nominated. And of course, it helped him survive that war. He was able to keep disparate strands of the political North behind him, even though he was violently, literally, but also just attacked in the newspapers constantly during that war.
Well, you've referred to the times in which we live, and I can only suggest to our readers that if you want to read about an event in American history that rhymes with our history of the moment, may not duplicate it, but it sure rhymes. I think Mark Twain used those terms, but this is the book. I can't recommend it enough. It's The Lincoln Miracle Inside the Republican Convention That Changed History by Ed Acorn. Ed, I want to thank you for joining us today at Reader's Corner. This has really been a real treat for us to learn more about this book. And I know we have many listeners here going to get out now and get a copy of it. So thanks for being with us. Appreciate it.
Bob, thank you. It's been a treat for me.
Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.